I remember the day when John Barber used to say, right here on this program, he went out and played golf, and it was hot, and he loved it. It's too hot for John. It's something else going on beside just the heat. The heat is withering, but what people are missing is a simple fact that UVB, that's the burning ultraviolet radiation wavelength, UVB, that's what gives you your tan in a tanning salon, is now, instead of 6%, 7%, been measured at up to 45%. Dane told me that a long time ago. And that's bad. That's why you go out and you can feel a stinging on your skin right through your clothes. That's UVB going right through and stinging your skin. UVC is also now a common factor, and UVC shouldn't even be around. So that's part of the discomfort of being out in the heat. Hello, Johnny. Welcome back.
Oh, I wish you hadn't reminded me of the heat. I'm so delighted to be talking to you, but I am so tired and exhausted. I've just finished eating my 15th popsicle.
Well, good for you. Now, yeah. All right. Good.
Hey.
Popsicles, yes, love them. Used to, anyway.
Okay. Yeah, well, you said that I would love to go out and play golf every day. Do you know that if the heat has encased me in my house much more than that year of COVID, at the very height of COVID, when everybody was absolutely locked up, I wasn't. Every afternoon, I would drive out to Boulder Creek Golf Course, which was deserted, and mm-hmm. I'd take a 7-iron, take off my shirt, and I'd go into the driving range where 1,000 golf balls would be still lying around, and I would spend 2 hours with a 7-iron hitting those golf balls all over the place, and now I'm home and locked up, and guess what I now can do with a golf ball?
I fear to think.
I can only putt. So when this stuff is over, the only golf I'll be talented enough to play
miniature golf
is miniature golf. So,
I get it.
Yeah, oh my God, it's just been god awful. So why don't you ask me, how hot is it?
Hi, I was getting there. How hot is it in Las Vegas, Mr. Barber?
Jeff, it's so hot. If my house caught fire, I'd be safer inside.
Cute.
Okay.
All right. That's
okay.
Another vintage little barbarism. Very good.
Okay. Ask me again.
How hot is it really, John? Come on.
Jeff, it is so hot in Vegas. Last week, one of the runways at the airport melted, and they found Jimmy Hoffa.
You got a million of them. Probably another million left. That's great.
Here's the last one.
All right, now seriously, John, hold on. No more kidding around.
Hang on a second.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, you got to ask me one more time. This is my favorite.
All right.
Go ahead. Ask me one more time.
Seriously. Now, no more kidding. How the hell hot is it there in Las Vegas?
It is so hot that it has really a horrible adverse effect on hundreds of people who live here. Some of the rectal thermometers register 110.
Shame. Shame.
Hey. And get this.
All right.
Get this. Last week, Trump was here. So to paraphrase William Shakespeare, hell was empty because one of the devils was in Las Vegas.
God.
Oh, my God. It has been beyond brutal. Mm. And so I'm locked at home. And I don't know about you, but if I am not, you can tell by my going out and playing golf, if I am not physically and mentally active, Jeff, I literally get really semi-crazy and semi-angry. And I'm at the stage now where I feel I may go postal and run out like a mad dog and an Englishman in the noonday sun.
Like Winston Churchill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no coward. And hijack a Good Humor ice cream truck. You know, I could go at noon a month ago, always to the post office to pick up the mail.
Right.
And, of course, I cannot do that now, so I wait till 7 o'clock at night. And I go out at 7 o'clock at night, and I still can't do it because during the day, the sun bakes the concrete, and your feet feel the heat. So I feel like a human waffle. I have to wait till almost midnight so I can pick up the mail.
That's something very few people think about, that the heat, the concrete gets into it and it gets into the asphalt and everything heats up, and it's actually re-radiating the solar heat. So you're really in trouble.
Yes.
Yeah, too hot.
Well, this year has been the very, very worst year I've spent in 25 years in Las Vegas. The first 3 months, I couldn't go out to play golf because it was rainy and cold and windy, and now I can't play golf because of the heat. Now I've stayed home, and I'm locked in the house. And, of course, sometimes I like to be informed. And we have 24 hours of news on both CNN and MSNBC. So to be informed, I turn it off.
Good job. Good.
Well, the thing is, what it is, now you don't watch TV, so you won't know this, but everybody who's listening to us, who no matter what time of day you tune in to CNN or you tune into MSNBC, they're the two worst offenders, it's 24 hours of Donald Trump. And it's nothing new. We have all heard it. Now, what happens if you go out in the sun? It bakes your body. But if you watch MSNBC or CNN and it's Trump all day long, it bakes your brain.
I had no idea. They can't come up with any other programming than covering Trump, basically.
Yes, it's just ghastly. Now, listen, I don't know if you feel the same way about this as I do, but it's been two some odd years since January the 6th. Yeah. And January the 6th was the Republicans' December 7th. And you well know there are a couple of dozen people who were in prison because they assaulted the Senate building, okay? But if you rewind those pictures, you see that the guy that's urging them to assault the Senate is on camera for 8 minutes, and he's not been arrested. And it was William Shakespeare who said 400 years ago, the first thing we do after the revolution is kill all the lawyers. And Hamlet was contemplating suicide because of the law's delay. Now, Charlie Manson never publicly encouraged any of his followers to murder anybody at the Sharon Tate house. He had nothing to do with the murders. It was Tex Watson and those girls.
That's one
of them was released, okay? And yet, they round him up, put him on the cover of Life magazine, and he spends his life in prison. But I don't want to. I don't want to talk about much about Trump because I'll have something to say about them later, but there's something I would like to mention very briefly, if you don't mind. It's a post that I was inspired to write by one of the most brilliant people that I have ever read, ever met. I don't even know her. She's a Serbian, lives in Serbia. Can I read this to you?
Yes, of course. I'm looking forward to it. Go ahead. Okay, I don't know about this.
I'm encouraged to write this very brief post, Jeff. After a few elevating conversations with Alexander Milutic, one of the very few geniuses I know, she is a Serbian writer of philosophy, history, politics, and movies, especially American movies. You can see the evidence of her genius and her insight on my Facebook page in the unbelievable, fantastic review she wrote about Carol Hennig's book about my 10 years as a film critic, the greatest reviews I ever read. Alexandra's review is more than the greatest review I ever read. It is the greatest essay I ever read on the decline of both American movies and culture, as well as that of Europe. She is an inspiring joy to talk to about anything, and as a result of listening to another joyful chat with her today, she has inspired me to write this brief observation about the world as I am locked in my 15th consecutive day of nearly 115 degree heat. Here it is. Mankind should forget about nature's calamities of global warming, of earthquakes, of tornadoes, of wildfires, of floodings, or melting glaciers, because it's mankind's own calamities that he should worry about. It's his own calamities that will bring him down. Isn't that terrific? And isn't that true?
Well, yes. It's a splendid statement. Look at the economy of words and yet the impact of it. It's all there. That's really good stuff.
And the other thing is, she is the biggest fan of my book, which she knows I would have never written had it not been for you. And she's working right now on two historical and philosophical essays. And when she gets through, she is going to translate it into Serbian. She said, because she's extremely well known in Serbia, and she thinks, when she's in literature classes with people, they ask her who the greatest American writer is. And she says, John Barber. Can you believe that? And then she says to me, you know, and I'm embarrassed by it. I said, don't be silly. And she said, find somebody who writes better than you. And so I have to thank you, Jeff, again, because if I hadn't been on with you for all these years, I would have absolutely never, ever, ever written that book. And the only other person who ever got close to saying that close a compliment to me, aside from you, was your friend and mine, Donald Jeffries. Donald said the greatest book ever written in English is Charles Dickens' David Copperfield. John Barber's book is David Copperfield Goes to Hollywood. So...
That's a very elegant compliment. That's nice.
Yeah.
Thank you for nudging Don this way. He's on every Monday, as you know, and we always have wonderful conversations. He's extraordinary.
You made that happen,
so thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, all these magnificent things that have happened to me really happened by accident, and getting Donald to write the foreword to my book was an accident. But the person who wanted to write the foreword to it was Harlan Ellison. You remember Harlan Ellison? Harlan Ellison was one of America's greatest, well, I hate to say science fiction writers, but he would kill me if he ever heard me say that. But he was up there with Nabokov, and there's another American. There were three great writers of science fiction, and he was one of them. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that wrote The Terminator, and Paramount Studios stole it, made a movie out of it, which made Arnold Schwarzenegger a bigger star, so he was going to sue them. And his mm-hmm. agent and his manager and his publicist and his wife, everybody said, don't sue. And he says, nobody's going to screw with my work and steal from me. So he sued them and won millions. And then he took out a huge ad at Sunset and Doheny over a big music store that says, I beat the bastards. And he worked more than ever. And there are wonderful stories about Harlan.
That's it. That's terrific. I didn't know this. No, that's
yes.
good.
Well, I'll tell you what Harlan was like. Basically, when he was in college, he told his professor he wanted to be a writer,
mm-hmm.
and his writer always gave him D's and F's. He says, "You'll never be a writer." So within a year, he sold his first story to one of these pulp magazines for 50 right. bucks, mm-hmm. and he sent the receipt, the check stub, to his professor.
Good.
And for the rest of his entire life, the check stub from every one of his sales, he wrote some of the greatest Star Wars episodes. He wrote some of the greatest Twilight Zone episodes, some of the greatest movie episodes, and every check stub he sent to that professor till the professor died.
That's funny.
Died. Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah.
funny.
Yeah.
Oh, so, good for him. What's Harlan doing now, John?
He died a year ago. That's why he died 4 years ago. That's why he was unable to write the foreword to my book. But I'll tell you, two quick stories about Harlan. When I was signed by Merv Griffin to replace him when he went to CBS,
mm-hmm.
I had to do a 90-minute show, a complete show with guests. And one of them, one of my main guests was a guy named Claude Keeley, who was a really handsome Frenchman. He was sort of the Earl Flynn of France on the on the slopes and skis, lots of women and anything like that. I mean, he was a major star. And of course I opened the show doing a stand-up, because that's what Jack Parr did, who was my idol, stand-up. So my ratings were slightly higher than Merv's. So I was all excited until I read Harlan Ellison's review. Harlan Ellison used to write this great column about television in the, I think it was called The Free Press in Hollywood. And the title of his column was called The Glass Teat, T-E-A-T. What a wonderful title for a column about television. And he, in essence, called me a fag.
Really?
Yeah, he said, how did they happen to find this fag? Because he didn't like the way I interviewed John Claude Keeley. He just didn't like it. Okay. So anyway, what happens is they use my ratings to get that Englishman's, who was the guy that ended up replacing Merv Griffin? David Frost.
Frost.
He used my ratings to get his money down. But Chuck Young in Los Angeles, who put Joe Pine on the air, said the mm-hmm. Englishman's going to bomb and I'm going to hire John Barber so that when the Englishman bombs, he will have died.
Oh, did he? Yeah.
Yeah, he awful. Eventually bombed. But anyway, so he hires me. My producer's Bill Walker. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the most important thing in the world was television. It was the electronic umbilical cord, as Ed Murrow said, that could sustain us, inform us, or dwarf us, and turn us into idiots or geniuses. Well, it turned us into idiots. But there was a time when it bordered on turning us into geniuses. So I wanted somebody to be on my show to talk about television. So I told Bill, I said, you know, I'd like to call Harlan Ellison. He said, I'm not going to call him. He hates you, for God's sake. Well, I'll call him. So I look it up in the white pages, and there's his phone number. So I pick up the phone, and I dial it, and he answers right away. Yeah. And I said, is this Harlan Ellison? And he said, yeah. And I said, this is John Barber. He says, holy shit. And I said, hold it a minute. You already said that in the review. Well, he started to laugh. And he says, I'm not changing anything. I said, oh, Harlan, can you speak as well as you write? He says, you fucking idiot. What are you asking such a stupid question for? Certainly I can. Why are you asking such a dumb question? And I said, because I'm starting a talk show on Channel 11 on Saturday night. It's like a poor man's Tonight Show. And I would love you to be my very first guest. He said, are you shitting me? And I said, no, are you kidding? I wouldn't do that to you. He said, I'll be there. What do you pay? I said, it's $72. That's all I pay. He said, I don't care. He said, it'll give me a platform. So he comes on the show, and the show's fantastic. He is brilliant. Oh, my God. Uh-huh. And the ratings are terrific. Everything is wonderful. So Chuck Young calls me the next day, and he's gloating. He's so, so happy. He said, John, I'm telling you, he said, I thought I did right hiring Joe Pyne, but I'm happier that I hired you. I mean, that was a fantastic show. I'm getting a lot of really nice phone calls. And guess who just left my office? I said, who? He said, Harlan Ellison. I said, that's great. Are you going to give him a show? And he said, no, I'm not giving him a show. I said, well, you should. He's brilliant when it comes to talking about television. Why aren't you giving him a show? And Chuck started to laugh, and he said, because he wants your show. He thinks you're a fag.
Oh, God.
So, okay,
oh, that's hilarious.
It is
that's,
so.
That's too funny.
Every time I got a show after that, and I had 6 or 8 local talk shows, Harlan Ellison was the first guest I ever called.
You do things so uniquely, so individually. You march to your own tune. That's really remarkable. That's great.
Well, it gives
somebody called me a fag in a god major newspaper format or whatever the hell it was. I wouldn't call him and ask him to be a guest on my show. You do. That's how you think. That's at the seat of the comedy that stems from your soul. You are really a funny. You turn things inside and out, and they're laughable, and it works.
Well, it's because Harlan can say things on the air that I cannot say. You know, to me, oh God, you know, can I say something else? Because I'll tell you, there is nobody except this lady in Serbia that I can listen to. There's nobody but you when you're with Donald Trump. And then the guy that talks about economics. What's his name? Oh, you know who I mean. The guy that has... You know who I'm talking about. He's brilliant when he... Huh?
On this program?
Yes, you have him on, I think, once a month or once
Mike McGill?
No, not him. The guy that... You have his commercial. He talks about economics all the time. Huh? You know who I'm talking about?
Of course I do. Gerald Celente.
Gerald Celente. I love him. I love him. My God. But it's...
Thank you.
Anyway, so there's not a lot for me to listen to. So I go back and I deeply miss George Carlin.
Bill Hicks,
and even Bill and Joan Rivers. And I also miss Gore Vidal, And so I go back and listen to them. So I have written something here that, oh, hang on a second. Where is it? If I can find it.
I wrote you a little note about Joan
Did you really?
Today. Didn't you get it?
No. No. Yeah. Hang on. What did it say?
Oh, I just mentioned you sent me your Facebook post, and there was a picture of Rodney Dangerfield.
And, oh, yes. Yes, that was my post about being on your show tonight. Okay, so this is, I don't want to talk about Trump again, but I sent you something that I hope we get time to play. But I want, this is sort of a last thought about that. Do you mind if I read this to you?
No, please.
Okay. In this totally screwed up country, and you know I don't like to swear, but I did swear a bit because I was quoting Harlan, okay? But if you watch George Carlin or Bill Hicks or Joan Rivers, my God, the profanity pours out. So I'll just try to limit it a little bit. Anyway, in this totally screwed up country and Barbie doll culture, I miss more and more Bill Hicks and George Carlin, Joan Rivers. And if they were alive today, I promise you they would probably be saying this about today's news. And this is today's news, Jeff. That's why I wrote it. Mm-hmm. Quote, is Trump fucking kidding? With each passing day that he's not in prison, he gets this more magnificent image of himself. Today he said, quote, if I go to jail, it'll be a bad day for the country, unquote. Up until today, he's been yelling at us that he's the president, just the president. Now he says he's a fucking country. Let's forget all this bullshit about making America great again, which will never happen until they clean up the murder of John Kennedy. So till then, let's just see if we can just make the law great again.
Ah, nicely said. Yeah.
Well,
under everything is the law. And unfortunately, it's been swept away and is being changed constantly. Here's what I said about your Facebook post with a picture of Rodney Dangerfield in it.
Yes.
I just wrote, good that you posted that. Rodney was a great talent. I sat about 15 feet away from him at the Flamingo and got to see him work the audience. Wow. And I wrote then, so was Joan. Joan used to call me at the TV station and invite me to come over up to her suite at the top of the MGM after I finished the late news at KTNV. All the headliners would stay in that five-star suite. It was quite a place. Joan was a good friend of mine. I was very fortunate.
Well, at one point, she called me and asked me to produce her show. So I was there at her house with her husband, and I said, Joan, I don't want to produce your show, but I think I would be better as your straight person, your Ed McMahon.
You would have been. That's really correct.
Her husband agreed right away.
And Edgar.
Edgar. So she said, really? And I said, well, listen, look at how wasp I am. I look like Bob Newhart, for God's sake. And I'm very quiet. And you're very loud and you're very Jewish. I mean, it's a perfect pair. So Edgar tried to induce her to have her do that. And I think shortly after that, committed suicide. And she did the liner notes along with Neil Simon, Paul Williams, and Burt Reynolds on my second album called I Met a Man I Didn't Like, which was all about my movie reviews. Now, I'll tell you about Rodney Dangerfield. I was on the Merv Griffin show the day Rodney Dangerfield made his comeback. Now, I must tell you, I never forget a joke, whether it's mine or anybody else's. I mean, when I have, if you go to my half hour with Bob Hope, when Bob Hope called and tried to get me fired because I said he should retire because he's becoming the J. Edgar Hoover of humor, on my show, he talks about how he accidentally became a comic and recited the jokes from like 80 years ago. And I loved him for it. Okay. Now, in my book that you encouraged me to write, I knew all of these comics and I knew them personally and well, and especially Rodney Dangerfield, because he had a really hilarious line. He was over 40. He was selling aluminum siding, and he decided he wanted to get back in show business. So his opening line was, he said, "I retired from stand-up comedy a few years ago to sell aluminum siding." And he said, "But I'm the only one who knew it." Well, that was so funny. Oh, my God. So afterwards, I went over and I complimented on it. And he said, "Hey, I loved your set. I'm the MC at the Comedy Store here in New York. And I'd love you to come down and either do a set or watch the guys do sets." I said, "Well, I don't want to do a set. First of all, I couldn't compete with you. But I just like to relax. I don't want to do anything but a few things on television." So I go down. This is how powerful he was. He was Rodney. Better than Lenny Bruce or Bill Hicks. He attacked the audience. He was better than Don Rickles. He was hilarious. He tore them to pieces. So when it was, and he got a standing ovation, and he did that every night. So he invited me into his dressing room. Everybody comes in and congratulates him, and he kicks them all out, and I'm getting up to leave. He says, "No, John, I want to stay here and talk to you." I said, "Talk to me about what?" "I just want to talk to you. You're peaceful," he says to me. And so I said to him, "Can I say something to you?" He said, "You can say anything you want to me." I said, "You know, I've seen Lenny and I've seen them all. You could fill Carnegie Hall doing what it is you're doing. I mean, you're a powerhouse on stage. Why is it that you do this thing where you tug your tie and you say, 'I get no respect'?" Without missing a beat, he says, "Because I want to work." I said, "What do you mean you want to work?" He says, "Hey, John, audiences always have to feel superior to the performer. Why do you think that there are so many successful Jewish comics or Irish comics or black comics? Is because the audience always feels superior to them. So I do. I get no respect." My mother said, "Don't take a ride in a car from a stranger unless he offers you candy," which is a very funny line. He had millions of them. So I tell the story, these stories about these comics that nobody knows about in my autobiography, which I would have never written had it not been for you. And now it might become a bestseller in Serbia, of all places.
That's a really a testimonial to the worldwide message of humor. And you are Mr. Humor.
Well,
that's the truth.
On a very special
platform you have all to yourself. There's no one like you. There never will be. Rodney was brilliant. You are, John, come on, you are one of a kind. You always have been, and that's why people are so drawn to you. You don't copy anybody. You don't rip anything off. You are a true original, and I'm not blowing smoke at you. It's too hot down there to blow smoke, so there you go.
Okay, I have one other thing if I can find.
Here, before you do that, Let me play this little tiny clip from Rodney, okay?
Oh, wonderful. Go ahead.
I think it'll be loud enough. Let's hope. All right, here we go.
Cat ugly. What was he ugly? How ugly? I took him to the beach. They asked me what I used for bait. When I took her home, my mother put newspapers on the floor. I gave her a hickey. I got fur on my mouth.
All right. Anyway, Rodney was just one after the other after the other. He knew how to do it.
Yeah. I can't find it. Maybe I will find it. But I sent you a couple of videos that are mostly audios, but I put pictures on them when I put them on Facebook because...
I have them. I got them right here.
Okay. Well, you know what? The first one is short and sweet, and I think you'll like it because about the end of April, on my 90th birthday, Stu Shostak, who was Lucy Ball's best friend who was the one that transferred all her material to her, and Lucille Ball told Stu that her favorite writer next to the guys that wrote her show was John Barber because of his reviews in L.A. Magazine. She and her husband used to fight over them every month. So Stu became a huge fan, and he saved all the stuff, built me a new website. So he wanted to do a couple of shows. And the first show was to be 2 hours long about my reviews, ended up being 3.5 hours long live. And then the second show, which followed it, was live. He wanted to do a 2-hour show on my interviews, and it turned out to be 3.5 hours long, but I was exhausted. So he asked me at the end to comment on what it was like to be 90. And I said, hey, I'm too tired to talk. So I just did this little poem. Maybe you could play that.
Yeah, I'm ready. All right, here we go.
Okay.
Let me turn this up. It starts out with Stu. Here we go. Okay.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, my buddy, my pal, Mr. John Barber, is about to let everybody know what it's like to turn 90 years old. Mr. Barber.
Oh, Stu. Again, thank you, thank you, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, because I know how much work you've done into this. Anyway, I have to put on my glasses and read this to you here. Folks, now that I turn 90, you might expect me to be saying a lot, but no, this is all that I've got to say. To me, there's only one profession I've admired during the many bumps in my road of life along my way. That, of course, is the entertainment business or show business. Truly nothing like it, wrote Irving Berlin. As a struggling child, teen, and youngster watching it, then as a man in it, it lifted me daily through thick and thin. First, I loved the actors and the actresses, big and small, on the screens, big and small, who played others as I longed to do. Then it was the writers who wrote their stories, who gave them their lines, which gave me dreams that might come true. Then the talented songwriters who fashioned magical music out of thin air, and singers who gave the human voice its greatest sound. And of course, the many dancers of all types who could tap and waltz and twirl and do things with their bodies and seem to float right off the ground. Above all, I may have loved the comics the most. Singles or in pairs, working in pantomime, slapstick or words. Because what I learned from some of them is that I could laugh at politicians, preachers, pontificates, and experts who were really obvious turds. To everyone that was in this much-needed business, big or small, rich or famous, known or unknown, to each and all goes my heart. At 90, because of all my dreams come true, inspired by all the above, I thank the gods for my great luck for having played in show business a small part, a small, but some say, important part.
Beautiful. John Barber, ladies and gentlemen.
I've been very, very lucky, Jeff, you know.
Wow. Well, that was beautiful. That was really a beautiful piece.
Well, thank you so much. I thought you would like it. And I find, as I've mentioned to you often, while I obviously love to write prose, sometimes I'm so moved and lifted spiritually, if you'll say, I like to write in rhyme. I don't call it poetry because I don't think of myself in any way as a poet, but it's prose that rhymes. And sometimes when I feel really sad, I don't like to write prose because it sounds like I'm complaining. So I also do that. One of the last poems that I write that I'm proudest of was last August. The Pope went to Canada to apologize to the Canadian Indians for 150 years of unbelievable criminal savagery with a Catholic Church tearing children away from their mothers and fathers, not letting them speak their language, and when they died, they were in unmarked graves. It had almost no coverage at all. And so I wrote a poem about it. So if you go to my site, it's the Pope apologizing to Canada. Now, the next thing, I think we'll only have time for this. I wanted to get to the Trump thing, which is wonderful, but enough Trump for now.
John, we only have 8 minutes, and the 88, is 9 minutes and 47 seconds, so we can't do the 88th this show. We'll have to do it next program.
Oh, my God, you're kidding.
No, we have too much fun talking. People love to hear you, just stream of consciousness.
Oh.
Go for it. It's
Oh, my gosh. Well, shame on me for crying out loud because
that's one
of the best. We might
be able to sneak it in, but I don't think so. The computer is going to cut us off. How long is the Trump piece?
Oh, no, the Trump piece is 19 minutes.
Let me tell you
just a little bit about the Trump piece, which is called Why Do People Still Love Trump?
Mm-hmm.
And I play golf with a dozen or so guys who are very, very successful here in town. Half of them are millionaires in various fields. Some of them manage some of the hotels, by the way. And they all voted for Trump. And we're the closest of friends. And I asked them, because it's true, why are they voting for a guy that's obviously dumber than they are? Which is true.
That's funny. That's good.
Well, it's true, but they couldn't stand Biden. And then get this. They are doing better today economically than when Trump was president, and they're still bashing Biden. Now, this guy, Bob Woodward, interviewed Donald Trump. Donald Trump made this a dreadful mistake. Well, he made a whole lot of mistakes.
Yes,
but
he made this dreadful mistake
of letting Bob Woodward interview him for about 48 hours. So it's all on tape. And Bob Woodward, of course, wrote a book. And at the end of the book, his very last sentence in the book is, how could anybody possibly know this right from the man's mouth and then see what he does and vote for him? How could they like him? And he went on Rachel Maddow's show twice to talk mm-hmm. about the book. Mm-hmm. And both of them, Rachel Maddow and Bob Woodward, you know, were almost sobbing about the fact that how could anybody like this guy? Well, I thought about it long and hard, and it came to me immediately. I mean immediately, because if there is a talent that I have that I will, I don't want to admit to being able to write or write jokes or write poetry or do stand-up or anything, do videos or anything. But if I have a talent, it's a talent to see the obvious. Now, that sounds like an egomaniacal thing to say, but it's so true. And it started when I was 6 years of age, when
John, you just said something. Hold on. The obvious is elusive to most people. They don't see it.
Yes, but how do you, as a six-year-old kid, okay, the first time of missing this, we were reading Hans Christian Andersen's tale about the emperor's wearing no clothing. And the kids were very impressed by learning this. So I put my hand up and Miss English said, yes, John, what? I said, well, if the emperor's wearing no clothing, Miss English, shouldn't he be arrested for indecent exposure? How does a six-year-old kid say that? And she booed me, so the class booed me. And I never got to repeat the line until Frank Sinatra had me on the Tonight Show, and I was using it as a straight line to set up a joke, and they got an ovation. I mean, it was that simple. Then the next time was when I was 12 years of age. And I had a friend, Donnelly, and his family who lived on Scarborough Road, which was a block away from me, was the only functional family I knew, only one that wasn't screwed up. And I went there one day and knocked on the door and asked the mother if they would adopt me. She said, no, you can't be adopted. You have your mother. I said, well, you want to come to my place and I'll show you she's not there? She says, where is she? And I said, she's in Buffalo, New York with another one of my uncles that I've never met. Okay, mm-hmm. So now 12. So she gives me a Bible. She said, will you come to church with us? Well, I wanted company. I wanted a mother and father. So I memorized the Bible, and I go to the church. Now, the minister is really smart because after the universal prayer, he has a solitary prayer for every individual. He gives us a quiet minute. He said, you all say your personal prayers. So my prayer was that when I would get home, my father would be there. And I left church. I never went over to Donnelly's house. I just would rush home, open the door and holler, Dad, Dad, Dad. And there was an echo. There was no father, but there mm-hmm. was an echo. So after 13 weeks at the church, Baptist church, when he tells us to have our private minute, I just get up and walk out. He notices and everybody else notices. And I sit down on the concrete and I wait. So out he comes. He puts his hand on my shoulder. And I almost cry, Jeff, because it's the first time anybody ever touched me. Then he says, son, now tears come to my eyes because nobody ever called me son. And he said, are you okay? And I said, no, father, because I didn't know what else to call him. No, mm-hmm. father, and this is not for me. And he said, what's not for you? And I said, this prayer stuff. And he said, hold it. Young man, you must understand God's will. And I blurted out, I don't think I'm in it. So everybody started to laugh. And sure. Then he got angry that they were laughing at my joke. And I didn't mean it as a joke. It popped out of me. So he said, "Don't let the devil take you over." And I said, "What happened?"
Finish your story. We're out of time. You go ahead. We've got another minute.
Don't let the devil take you over. And I said, "Do you believe in the devil?" And everybody cussed. And if the Ahab people not been there, he'd have struck me. And he said, "Absolutely." And I said, "Well, isn't that proof there's no God? Because if there were God Almighty, wouldn't he get rid of the devil?" That came out of a 12-year-old boy.
Unreal. That's unreal.
I've been that way all my life. It just pops out of me like Nikola Tesla said he never invented anything. It just came to him out of the universe.
Well, that's why I said earlier, you are absolutely one of a kind. You're a conduit for the muse. And that's a gift that just doesn't come along. It's you're born with something special.
Next time we'll do the 88 thing, because people need it, because everybody asks me, what's the secret of growing old when there is no secret, okay?
We shall do it next time.
Okay,
thank you, Johnny.
You're a joy. Thank you.
You too. All right, my friend. Good night. John Barber, the one and only. Okay, have a good weekend. We'll be back soon. Take care.